these talks came under the general theme of in his image and for his glory, in which we started in Genesis with what I would call God's unfinished creation. Because in Genesis 1:26, God's mission statement tells us that he wanted to create the man and the woman in his image and in his likeness. And in verse 27, we're told that he did indeed, he made the woman in his image. But the likeness is missing. The creation was not completed in Eden, because becoming like God, that is, developing the character of God, is a lifetime process, and it's actually, I believe, it's our reason for being. And then we endeavoured to show the ongoing character creation of God, working out in the lives of some Bible characters who are models for us, showing us the transforming power of God as he strives to finish his creation in everyone, everyone who allows him access to their insides, so that he can finish the job he started, to make us not only in his image, but in his likeness. So we looked at Hannah, and we looked at Esther, and we looked at Philemon. And the last talk in the series was about some of the women who Jesus encountered, and that's what we're going to look at today. I hope this works. These encounters at the time of the Roman Empire, these encounters were radical. They were confronting. You could almost say that they were outrageous in terms of the prevailing cultural environment. And unless we really absorb that fact, we're going to miss out on the principle that Jesus interpreted for us, so that we may know as women that whatever the social values of the communities are into which we're born, we are greatly loved by God and equal in the eyes of the Father. When we actually research ancient civilizations, we find that most societies were patriarchal. That means that these societies were ruled over by men, and women were considered either inferior or less important. Women belonged to men, initially their fathers, and then they married and the authority was transferred to their husband. And Israel was no exception. It was a patriarchal society, but that does not mean that God instigated it to be so, or that he approved of it. Nor does it mean that every male in that society conformed to that behaviour. Now, I just want to try and get the slides up, just a sec. Somebody's waiting. Okay. Just give me 1 minute. Can you see that slide?
Yes.
Is that coming up?
Yes, it is.
Okay. All right, then.
Well, you don't want to sit around here and be seen.
As I said, the Bible records history. It doesn't justify it. Ancient civilizations, including Israel, practiced things of which God did not institute or approve. And in a primitive agricultural society, the female biology rendered her very dependent on the strength of the male to support her and their family. And there's actually nothing wrong with that, except if that support is abused or mistaken for power and control. And there's a saying which I think is very true, both from an historical aspect and our modern culture, and that is, he who can exploit will exploit, unless he has developed a moral conscience that motivates him to relinquish power. And I use the word he here in the generic sense, because it can be he or she. Exercising power is often not restricted, is not only restricted to males. It's based on circumstances, vulnerability, and opportunity. For example, Goliath would be no threat today for an elderly lady with a machine gun in her hand. But if you look closely, God's concern for the exploitation of the vulnerable can be seen embedded in his law. It's almost like he's saying, if love and compassion doesn't motivate you to care for the people in whom you're supposed to care for, then law should. Now, here are just a few things. I'm going to pop them up, slip them on the screen. Here are just a few things of which God forbore with in Israel's history. And I'll move through them quickly so that you can just get the idea, and then perhaps if you want to, you can look these things up at your leisure. And the first one, of course, was divorce. Divorce was tolerated. Why? Oh, hang on. I've got some more people waiting. Sorry. Sorry about this. There's two more coming in. Is that back to the, is that back to the slide?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, the first one is divorce. Divorce was tolerated because of the hardness of men's hearts. But if a man did divorce his wife, he had to provide her with a bill of divorcement. That's not a certificate. That's a manifest. That's an itemized account of why that divorce took place. But once a man divorced his wife, he couldn't remarry her. So, of course, he'd been on the lookout for a second wife. So if the prospective second wife read the first wife's bill of divorcement, she might think twice before committing herself to that relationship. The second one is polygamy. These are just a few. And why isn't that working? Oh, sugar. Hang on. Sorry about this. These are some of the things we're going to... Okay. The second one's polygamy. God did not instigate polygamy. The model of marriage in Genesis was one man, one woman. But we read in the Old Testament of polygamous relationships, even among the faithful, and often with devastating outcomes. But if a man did marry more than one woman, then he had to provide for her equally, and you can read everything about that on the screen. God did not, approve of a monarchy.
It's not on the screen.
Not on the screen.
That's not on the screen?
No.
Here, you've got to share it?
Okay, I'll go back. Nothing's on the screen?
Believe
me. Only journeying Becky.
Is that better?
Yes.
Yes, that's right.
Is that better?
Yes.
Got it.
Yes.
Divorce, polygamy.
That one?
Monarchy.
Now, about the polygamy, did you read that?
Concerning polygamy. Yes.
Yeah, now this is...
One wife more favourably than another, or she's got to be separated. He must write a... Not consider himself above his brethren. God must choose the king.
Yeah. So, he didn't want a monarchy, but if they had to have one, well, these were some rules to temper it, to minimise the negative impact. And in terms of his daughters, he certainly did not approve of the subjugation or the repression of women who he had made in his image and for his glory. But why was Israel so structured anyway? Why did God's chosen people propagate and maintain this hierarchy system when it so plainly contravened God's edict that in the beginning he created both equal? Well, we have to keep in mind the fundamental principle that God is calling out a people for his name. He is not upturning established societies. God does not want people who are forced to obey him. The whole principle of service is voluntary. And as emphasized earlier, God's mission has always been to touch and change the hearts and the minds of individuals within the society, to create a moral conscience within individuals patterned on his own character that does not want to exercise and control another human being, so that we do not want to hurt or oppress or repress anyone, even if we could get away with it with impunity. But persuading people with power to relinquish control is difficult. And a centuries past so Jewish thought concerning women was influenced by the different ruling powers to whom they were in bondage. And it evolved based on an erroneous understanding of the Genesis record. And they reasoned that the downfall of mankind was entirely the fault of Eve. She was the temptress. Adam simply lured away by her wiles. And in order to protect themselves from her dangerous charm, they had to control all aspects of her life. He should be taught only the most basic of God's law, as she had a capricious and scatty brain. She should not voice an opinion in case she deceived man. She should be separated from men so as not to be a sexual distraction. Hence, she had a separate place in the synagogue. She was considered unclean, not to be touched for 7 days every month, nor should there be contact with anything she had touched. Women, in general, were valued as having been provided by God for men to produce children. Other than that, they presented major obstacles for the man who was trying to keep the law of Moses. And these attitudes, which were not of God, nor do we find expression of them in the Old Testament, they crept into Jewish law and tradition to the point that as we head into the Roman Empire at the time of Jesus, here are just a few of the prevailing views of the leaders of Israel concerning their women. I'm just going to flip them on the screen for a few seconds. Just take them in. Can you see that?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I'll get to them. There we go. Starts there. The words of the Torah. Have you got that?
Yes.
Do not speak excessively, for all women's conversation are lewd. Women are linked with witchcraft.
The Talmud, the voice of a woman is indecent?
Yes, yep.
Goodness.
Got that?
Yep.
There's somebody waiting to be admitted. Hang on. Seems when I admit someone, I can't go to the next. Stop that. Stop share and come back into it, I think. Who am I admitting? Somebody's just come in. Jerry. So we're having some problems. Can you see that?
Yeah.
Yes.
I've got to see if I can get, yeah, just, it seems once I admit someone, it goes the other way. And here's a good one. Blessed are thou, O God, for not making me a Gentile, a Samaritan, a slave, or a woman. And apparently that is still said in some quarters today. Does it remind you of anything? The Apostle Paul, being a zealous Pharisee, would no doubt have embraced these words. So he's actually displayed an incredible transformation when he penned these words in Galatians, which seem to have a direct link to that prayer, but a repudiation of those sentiments.
3:28.
And before we leave this depressing situation, here are just a few reasons why a man could divorce his wife in first century Israel. Now, as you read them, I'm not saying that every man and every woman's marriage was based on these premises. I just can't imagine that Joseph treated Mary in this way and a lot of the others. But what it does do is it represents the prevailing view of the Jewish leaders at the time, and there's plenty of supporting literature. And I want you to keep this background foremost in your mind as we consider some of the women Jesus encountered during his ministry, and then compare the social intercourse Jesus enjoyed with these women, the affection with which he held them, the honour he bestowed upon them, and the model he displayed of how men and women should interact in their everyday lives. And the Gospel of John in particular highlights this relationship. As most of us are aware, the fourth gospel is a book of signs. And the word Simeon is mentioned instead of miracle. And that's the English word which is used to describe maritime signalling. Each flag represents a letter of the alphabet. And it sends a code to the viewer. This book is telling us, look out. There's more meaning to these stories than meets the eye. Look for something beneath the surface. But its universal message is boldly outlined in what surveys have shown to be the most popular book, a verse of the Bible. And that is, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son, that whoever believed in him should not perish but have everlasting life. And that is something that the Jews, now when I'm using this word term, the Jews, I'm speaking about the leading Jews, the teachers, the hierarchy. And that's something that the hierarchy had a great deal of difficulty understanding, that God loved the world. They believed God loved the Jews, but the unclean world, well, that was something outside of God's covenant. So in this gospel, he goes to great lengths to showcase people who were not of Israel, who were not valued by Israel. Marginalized people, damaged people, women, people who were under the law or outside the camp or outside the Jewish hope. And I think by extension, people like you and me. But the Jews, that is the ruling Jews, being in darkness, they comprehended it not. Now, the account.
Before you go any further, Wendy's trying to come into the meeting.
Okay, I'll have to go out of this, I think, and let her in just a sec. I can't see her name coming up.
They're waiting on the phone because I got her in on the phone.
Oh.
Yeah, connecting.
Oh, Jory. She's coming up as a different name, is she?
Yeah, Tori Ryan.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Okay, sorry, Vince.
That's okay, yeah. Not a problem.
I thought you might have seen her, so.
No, when I've got the slide on, I can't see it.
I thought so, thought I'd let you know.
Yeah. Thank you.
That's all right, sorry to interrupt.
You're all right. I have to keep going on this because it's. Now the account of the woman of Samaria takes place quite early in the ministry of Christ, directly after the conversation Jesus has with Nicodemus, and we're going to see why shortly. The Samaritans, as we know, were doubly despised by the Jews. Any self-respecting Jew wouldn't even walk through the land of Samaria because even the dust on their feet was considered unclean. But in chapter 4 of John, Jesus walks straight through Samaria on his way to Galilee. And tired after a long journey, he rests beside a well whilst he waits for his disciples to return from buying food. When a lone Samaritan woman arrives at the well to fill her jug with water. Now, I'll go back because that was the opinion of Samaritan women as stated in the Talmud. That's terrible, isn't it? It's offensive. That means that in their opinion, in the Jewish opinion, Samaritan women were considered perpetually unclean, and anything they touched or handled would by association be defiled and contaminated. The strange thing is the religion that the Samaritans practiced was essentially the Jewish religion, based on the first five books of the Bible. They too looked for a Messiah, but they considered themselves to practice the pure religion of the Jews, the ones that they had forsaken after the captivity. Of course, the Jews in turn believed the Samaritans to be heretics, worse than Gentiles. It was a mutual hate affair. Now it was noon, in the heat of the day, when a woman arrived at the well at a place that was steeped in history, situated at the foot of Mount Gerizim, considered to be holy by the Samaritans, and from where the blessings and the cursings had boomed across the valley between the other mountain in the distance, Ebal, and the bones of Joseph lay buried nearby. And this lone Samaritan woman in the heat of the day approached the well to fetch water. There was something wrong. Women collected water early in the morning or at evening when it was cooler, and they usually did so with fellow women. But this woman was by herself. She was obviously not part of the social community. Now Jesus, who had been unable to drink from the well as he had no cup, he instigated a conversation with this woman when he asked her for a drink of water. Because the woman was taken back by what she obviously thought was the audacity of a Jewish man to speak with her, and she responded defensively. She said, you're a Jew and I'm a Samaritan. How come you're asking me for a drink? To which she replies, if you knew the gift of God and who it is that says to you, give me to drink, you would have asked of him and I would have given you living life. See, Jesus immediately took control and elevated this conversation onto a spiritual level. This is not going to be an idle chit-chat. And in so doing, he actually sets the scene for the theological debate that follows. And the real reason for this encounter is revealed. Yes, Jesus was thirsty, but that's easily remedied. A cup of water. But what was obvious is that Jesus recognised in this lady a neediness that would not be quenched with a cup of water, an emotional thirst that only the generosity of God could satisfy. So he actually suggests a possible solution to her problem, not his. If she could recognise who he really was, then he'd give her salvation, the gift of God, to all that believed that Jesus was the Son of God, even a Samaritan. Because she misses the point. Foremost in her mind is the Jewish-Samaritan friction. So she actually takes the opportunity to make a stand for her Samaritan heritage. Are you greater than our Father who gave us the well and drank it? Can you, a Jew, claim this personal relationship with the great patriarch Jacob who left us the well? Of course, by implication, where's the well that he left you? But Jesus disregards this. He's not going to be drawn into a... He's not going to be drawn in to a petty discussion of who left who a well. But he redirects his conversation onto a higher plane, and now he speaks in the first person. He says to her, whoever drinks of this water shall thirst again, regardless of who gave her the well. But whoever drinks of the water that I shall give shall never thirst. That the water that I shall give shall be a well of water springing up to eternal life. Now this statement hits a nerve. It breaks down her defences. And I think you can sense a touch of defeat in her reply. She actually reveals her dissatisfaction with the burden of her everyday life, as well as its lack of purpose and hope. She says, sir, give me this water so that I don't have to come here and draw water every day. In effect, there's got to be more to life than this, than the drudgery of coming here every day in order to survive, and if you've got it, I want it. So what do you think Jesus made of this reply? Well, I believe he had perceived in this woman someone struggling to survive in a harsh world. A woman trying to provide by herself for the necessities of life, without support, without companionship, without hope, a sad and a lonely and a somewhat embittered woman. And where did this melancholy stem from? Well, where does most women's melancholy stem from? Jesus said to her, go call your husband. The woman answered and said, I have no husband. Can't you hear the resentment in that answer? Well, what was Jesus' reply? He said, you have well said. The first thing to note is that Jesus commends her for her honesty in admitting the truth. Now, this is where we're going to think about whether or not the popular view, and you may know the popular view, that is that this woman of Samaria was a loose woman with a promiscuous past. We're going to re-examine, if you like, whether that's in fact a true picture. Is this woman a particularly immoral person? Because whilst we're all sinners, I know we're all sinners, we don't have a past like that. And as a consequence of that assumption, many take the message of this story as being the confession of the woman's shame and her subsequent conversion. But don't you think it is strange that a Samaritan woman would confess all her past sins to a man she had only just met, particularly a Jew? Because I am not sure that's where the emphasis should lie. So first question is this, why is it assumed that she had a promiscuous past? Why is the assumption so often made that the cause of the problem is the woman's sexual misconduct? Note this, it's Jesus who says she has had five husbands. Well, says some of the commentators, Jesus is just being polite and using the word husband in the sense of a de facto relationship. I've got somebody wanting to come in. I'll come in a second. But the word husband used here is the same word used to describe Joseph's relationship with Mary, or the bride of Christ when she meets her husband in Revelation. So where do we get permission to reinterpret these words as meaning something very different? To support the belief that she was a fallen woman. Now, if you bear in mind a woman could not divorce her husband in the Jewish Samaritan world, you actually left with the conclusion that this woman had either been married five times or divorced, ousted by her husband or a combination of both, and that is not immoral. That's tragic. Now, her current situation was not good, and she knew that. For she lived with a man who was not her husband, albeit didn't sound to me like a particularly happy relationship. But before we tuck, just remember her circumstances. We have here a woman, probably in her middle age, alone in the world, probably childless, which is a known reason for divorce, without a man to provide for her, no social welfare, no job opportunities, no way of providing for herself, a burden on the village, ostracised by society. Think about how we would survive in that situation. And rather than seeing a reproach in the words of Jesus, I see compassion and sympathy. And I think he's conveying to her that he's aware of the hardships of her past and the pain she's endured. I know your sorrow and the difficult situation you're in. And notice this, the woman of Samaria did not regard these words of Jesus as a slur on her character. The fact that he could reveal her past was proof to her she... How did he know this? He must be a prophet. Sir, I perceive you are a prophet. And if you look at the words of the woman when she returns to her village and proclaims, come, see a man who told me all the things I ever did. Well, this can legitimately be translated as, come, see a man who told me all the things that ever happened to me. These few words can make such a huge difference as to how you perceive this woman. It places the emphasis on events to which she fell victim rather than a lifestyle that she voluntarily sought. And I think this lady was targeted by Jesus not because she was any more a sinner than any one of us, but because he had compassion on her for all her life events. The sadness he perceived in her, her despair at her own situation and her great need she had experienced, she had expressed for something better. You know, when Jesus saved the woman taken in adultery, he said to her, sin no more. When he cured the impotent man beside the pool, he said, sin no more. But with the Samaritan woman, he said no such words. All he did, all Jesus did was make her aware he knew her situation. Because if you enforce a society in which there is no role or place for a woman without a man, how does a woman survive if she finds herself on her own? And then to make matters worse, that same society condemns her for living in sin. I want to ask you the question, have you ever heard of a man living in sin? Impregnated in this record is the silent truth that societies have to take some responsibility for the care and well-being of marginalised citizens, so that people are not forced into compromising situations just to survive. Now, I'm not trying to justify the woman's current living arrangement, but I can understand it, and I believe Jesus did also. And some things that are wrong just can't be remedied overnight. I've got a couple of people coming in here. Excuse me for a second. Some things which are wrong can't be remedied overnight. Some negative situations take time to fix. And sometimes we get ourselves into situations that are hard to undo, and God knows that. And if there's anyone, you know, here today that has a situation or a problem in your life, even if it's the result of your own poor choice, but which is difficult to extract yourself from, you know this, that the first thing to make things right is to take ownership of the wrong, to confess it to God. I know that this is not right. I know I don't have a husband. But will you guide me and lead me? And I trust in you to show me how I can begin the process of change. But now, of course, this woman knows that this is no ordinary Jew. And so she does something that is succinctly human. She takes the opportunity to question him on important matters of religion. In particular, she wanted validation of the Judeo-Samaritan conflict. She wanted to know that the Samaritans were doctrinally correct. So she says to him, and it doesn't work, hang on. But she says to him, our fathers worshipped in this mountain, and you say that in Jerusalem it's a place to worship. You've actually got to admire this woman. She believed in the Torah. She was willing to make a stand. Her belief mattered to her, and she wanted clarification that her understanding was right. But of course, Jesus puts it all into perspective. You know, how often have we argued over spiritual interpretations over life issues? He said to her, woman, believe me, the hour is coming when you shall neither worship the Father in this mountain nor yet at Jerusalem. He's saying, look, this is a pointless argument. God is not confined to any mountain or any city or any other geographical structure. So where should God be worshipped? Well, Jesus replied, woman of Samaria, unlike the beliefs of the Jews or the Samaritans, God is not confined to places or nationalities. He is seeking to be worshipped in the hearts of people. Any people, and of course, by insinuation, even Samaritans. Now, our confidence is a little shaken at this stage. I'm going to see if I can get the slide back.
Mm-hmm.
quite a few stories.
The confidence is now, she says, I know I don't understand everything, she says. Well, isn't that a refreshingly humble response? Isn't the older you get, the more you realise how much we don't know?
Mm.
I know I don't know everything, but I do know this. The Messiah, when he comes, will explain everything to us. You know, albeit misguided in her understanding of where the Messiah would come from, this woman was a woman of faith. And what is happening in this scene by the well is that Messiah was explaining to her everything she needed to know for her salvation. Salvation was of this Jew. And I believe Jesus was subtly directing the woman to consider her very hero that she mentioned in the first verse, her father, Jacob, who said in her Torah, in Genesis 49 verse 10, that salvation would come through Judah. The ancient meaning of the word is Jew.
Mm.
And the one thing we can be sure of is that this woman of Samaria got the point. All her previous reservations were dispelled, and so excited was she that she left everything. She even left her water pot, and she ran back to the village to proclaim to the countrymen, oh, I think I've found the Messiah. I've found the Messiah. And many of the Samaritans believed in Jesus because of what she told them. And do you know what? That makes the woman of Samaria the first person recorded in the New Testament to have gone forth and preached the good news of Jesus Christ.
Look at that.
And what is more, they listened to her and were converted. And this happened before Peter and the other disciples could even get their head round such a concept. I've got some more to admit. Just give me a second. Yeah, I'm sorry about this, but it's not...
It's hard, isn't it, doing it this way?
So what was Jesus' response to the traditions and the rules and the laws of the Jews? Well, I've got them up on the screen. He flaunts the Samaritan contamination bit. He instigated with a woman, an unclean woman in a public place. He was even prepared to drink from the same cup. Remember the thing? The Samaritan woman was unclean, not even anything she touched. He showed compassion on her past, recognition of her current situation, but he voiced no judgment. He discussed the Torah and religious doctrine on equal terms without disparagement. This woman's salvation was important despite her being a Samaritan, and he was in control of his own moral conduct. He did not see this woman as a temptress. And you can see on the other side that she showed all the things that we need. She recognised her need. She told the truth. Now, I think Jesus was absolutely marvellous, and what an example of how we should treat one another, particularly those people who are marginalised in our society. No big stick, just love and concern for a fellow human being. And why do you think this is found just after the conversation Jesus had with Nicodemus? Well, I suggest to you, it's so that we compare the difference. The most elite man of Israel versus the lowest woman of the Gentiles. She came to him at noon. He came at night. He was wealthy, educated and privileged. She was despised and in de facto relationship.
Wow.
He was a teacher in Israel, learned in the law. She respected her Torah but recognised she couldn't understand it all. Jesus engaged Nicodemus in a conversation about water. Unless a man be born of water, he didn't know what he's talking about. Jesus engaged this woman in a conversation about water. She acknowledged it and said, I want it. Nicodemus believed in Jewish exclusivism. The woman of Samaria recognised universal salvation if people acknowledge the Jewish Messiah. Nicodemus privately declares Jesus must be a teacher from God and then departs into the night, whereas the woman of Samaria proclaims that he is the Messiah. Do you think we're being told something here? Now, I don't want to undermine Nicodemus because he made a huge turnabout later. But at this point in time, who do you think was closer to salvation? What an amazing woman. Now, I know I've spent a lot of time on her, but this conversation that took place between Jesus and the woman in Samaria is the longest of any recorded, and I think I know now why. It's care rather than criticism, and it's conversion rather than condemnation. I just love her. I just think she's wonderful. Now, by contrast to this, I just want to spend a little bit of time talking about a Jewish family who lived in a township of Bethany, in particular the two sisters, Mary and Martha, who from, if you read it in Luke, we have an account of what was shaping up to be a domestic. Now, we don't know how this friendship began, but we know that it was a long-standing relationship and close. You can tell that by the language. Now, how many people here can empathise with Martha? She had so much to do. It had guests to entertain, food to prepare, household to run, supplies to be purchased. And you know what? There's actually nothing wrong with that. Because hospitality is a virtue. And generosity is lovely. And welcoming God into our, or people of God into our homes is part of the pleasure of friendship that God encourages. And ensuring the comfort and the well-being of others is selfless. And Martha was all of that. It's not that Martha was wrong in attending to her domestic duties. It was that she was distracted with them. The word means bogged down. Her own expectations and standards left no room for anything else. Her time was fully consumed, and she lashed out at her sister because she was tired, overburdened and frustrated. Well, I've done that. And her frustration was even directed at Jesus himself. Lord, if you cared, you wouldn't allow Mary to sit there. She actually accuses Jesus of not caring. But I love how Jesus replied. He's patient and he's kind, and he diffuses this tense situation with the double use of her name. It's this calming strategy. She says, Martha, Martha. I don't know what's going on. I can't see anything coming through. Jesus tries to diffuse this tense situation. He's Martha. Martha, that's a calming strategy. Haven't you used it yourself when someone's in a flat? Max has said to me 100 times, Mitzi, Mitzi, sit down, you know. It's beneficial for you to make time to sit and listen and learn of the things of God. And Mary's made a wise decision. And what was Mary actually doing? Luke tells us she was sitting at the feet of Jesus. Now, for a woman to sit at a man's feet, it wasn't normal. This expression portrays the imagery of a master instructing a disciple. And in the first century, this pose of sitting at the feet of a master was reserved for exactly that, except that it was men who sat at the feet of their great teachers. Remember Paul sat at the feet of Gamaliel? Women didn't learn.
The women learn in silence.
Men, whoever's talking, I can hear you. Women didn't learn. He who teaches is taught a Torah, teaches her obscenity. But here was Mary sitting at Jesus' feet, and Martha was being encouraged to join them because it's more important for her well-being that she would learn of God than any other responsibility she had. I love this. Jesus says learning was more important than housework. But Paul says in 1 Timothy 2, let the woman learn in silence. You know, we get so hung up on this word silence that we miss the pearl. Let the woman learn. And if it was translated correctly, it would be, let the woman learn in peace, with humility and respect, just like Mary. And don't let this newfound freedom allow you to think it's okay to go around teaching you can dominate men, to which, of course, we would all agree, for no one should seek to dominate another. The message of Christ is that all should submit and serve one another in love. You know, today's society says it's important to have me time. Time out for me. I'm worth it. But Jesus said 2,000 years ago, it's important for sisters to have God time. And I think that it's a timely reminder for all of us, because we can be so easily distracted by the pace of life we live. And the busier we are, the more we are in need of God time. And if that means compromising housework or whatever it is that is a distraction, then can I say to you, sisters, make a conscious choice to take time out for God. Now, some years later, in the final years of Jesus' life, we meet up again with Mary and Martha. It's another one of my favourite accounts. But what I want to concentrate on today is the love Jesus had for these two women and the impartiality of that relationship. The equal terms in which he conversed with them on all matters, including scripture. The sympathy and the compassion he showed them, his desire to help them when he saw their frustration and their sadness, his patience with them as they struggled to come to grips with the problems in their lives, even the mundane stuff. And I know that this helps me feel very loved, and I hope it does you too. Now, I want to conclude with a little consideration, only a brief consideration of Mary Magdalene. The fact is, we know very little concrete evidence about her. But some of the things that we're supposed to know, it's just absolutely unsubstantiated. Again, as so often the case with women, Mary has been labelled a reformed prostitute. Yet, despite this complete lack of scriptural evidence, Pope Gregory I in 591 AD declared her to be a former prostitute, and the seven demons of which she was cured are said to be the seven deadly sins resulting from her decadent lifestyle. It's that old bigotry again, handed down from the Jewish tradition and adopted by the church. The woman is the temptress and responsible for the man's misconduct. A prostitute is the lowest of women, but her clientele are exempt from moral judgment. So what do we really know about Mary Magdalene? Oh, I keep forgetting. Here's just a little few things that we do know. You know, this myth that she was a reformed prostitute continues today. In the US, there's a community in Tennessee named the Mary Magdalene Institute, and the purpose is to rehabilitate former prostitutes. It's a good cause, but the name, you know, perpetrates the myth. In every case where Jesus healed people with demons, he healed them of either a mental or a physical condition, not a lifestyle or an occupation. And as the number seven sort of symbolises or totality or complete, we can confidently say that Jesus cured Mary Magdalene of either a physical or a mental disease that was totally incapacitating. And for that life-saving miracle, she was forever filled with gratitude and love for the one who had cured her. And as a consequence, she became his loyal and loving disciple. But it is the honour bestowed upon her by Jesus that's her greatest legacy, in that he chose her, of all his disciples, to first witness and proclaim his resurrection. And we have this beautiful picture, and because that's what John's all about, is pictures. You know, pictures with sign, with lessons underneath, of this woman, grieving woman, making her way to the tomb in the pre-dawn light. And then running to the disciples with the news that the Lord had risen from the dead, to which, of course, they all scoffed. After all, who can believe the testament of a woman? But Peter and another disciple ran to the scene to see what all the fuss was about, and found it empty, with neatly folded grave clothes, following which they scratched their heads and they went home. But Mary returned to the garden, and a gardener spoke to her, and he said, "Woman, why are you weeping?" And she said, "Because they've taken away my Lord, and I don't know where they've laid him." And she turned to face him, but he said to her, "Mary." How different must he have looked, freed from the ravages of the agony and the pain of the crucifixion, free from the burden of his mission, having been groomed by the angels. His appearance would have been very different from her last encounter. But the voice, Jesus said, "My sheep recognize my voice." And she turned to him and said, "Rabboni, Master." And in utter joy she goes to embrace him, but he says, "Touch me not, but go to my brethren and say to them, I ascend unto my Father and your Father and your God and my God." And in so saying, Mary becomes the apostle to the apostles, sent by Jesus to preach the good news of the resurrection. But unlike the woman of Samaria, when she told her brethren that she'd found the Messiah, his disciples didn't believe it. Look, we have these two women, these we have these two women. One a Samaritan sent to the Gentiles, and one a Jew sent to the disciples. And all this happened while the future apostle to the Jews was in hiding, and the future apostle to the Gentiles was somewhere in Tarsus chanting his prayers. Consider the irony. It's magnificent. Let's just summarise the heroes that we've considered. In the earlier studies, we looked at Hannah. Hannah, who gave her only begotten son for the salvation of the nation. We looked at Esther, who was prepared to lay down her life that her people could live. The woman of Samaria declared Jesus to be the Messiah and went forth to tell the others the good news, making her conceptually the first apostle. Mary, the sister of Martha, chose that good thing to be a student of God's word, for which she's commended. And then there was Mary Magdalene. Jesus bestowed on her the greatest honour of all when he chose her to first reveal himself to his disciples after the resurrection. And all these women were alone, without the support of husbands, by being either single or married to someone who, for whatever reason, couldn't support them in their time of need. And, of course, we also looked at Onesimus, the slave. He's not even considered to be male or female. He was simply someone's property, just another marginalised person, a victim of a different power base and man's inhumanity to man. You know, one of the most important things I got out of this study is the realisation that Jesus does not expect less of the women he encounters than he did of the distinguished and the learned Nicodemus, because we actually have the same responsibility incumbent upon us as our brethren. The bar hasn't been lowered because we're women. The conversation not restricted or modified because we're women. Jesus engaged in scriptural discourse with women in the same way he did with men. He didn't regard them as temptresses with scatty mind. He treated them with equality and with respect. He wasn't interested in gender. He was concerned about their relationship with God and their salvation. And I want to leave you with an inspirational thought, another picture from John. Envisage a beautiful garden where a man laid where no man had ever been before. He is in a deep sleep. And the man is woken by the angels of God. The second Adam awoke from a deep sleep to find Mary Magdalene in the garden, just like Adam found Eve.
Mm.
He awoke from a deep sleep in the Garden of Eden.
Mm.
And in that, Mary, this beloved disciple, becomes the symbol of the multitudinous bride whom Jesus loves and for whom he died. We are the daughters of the King, and although unnamed, we are today the disciples whom Jesus loves. Never underestimate the love that God has for his daughters. Never feel undervalued, for God has gone to great lengths under difficult circumstances to show us otherwise. We are really very well represented in his word if we take the time to search it out. Just be confident that hand in hand with our fathers and our sons and our husbands and our brothers and all the very dear menfolk who enrich our lives, God created us in his image and for his glory, and accept the responsibility this great honour bestows upon us all. Thank you.